by taking away their printing presses. Bitcoin stops the creeping totalitarianism that weaponizes our own blood, sweat, and tears against us. It stops government's escalating ability to control all person-to-person exchange, their efforts to build a financial panopticon of Big Brother control. And finally, by getting governments out of the business of manipulating money, Bitcoin brings us a world without permanent crisis, without the boom-bust business cycles, without the inflation that ravages the people who those governments pretend to serve and love. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the show. This is Bitcoin Audible, and I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And happy Valentine's Day to everybody who happens to listen to this on Valentine's Day. It is Monday. We are starting off the week with a read. We are jumping back into the Bitcoin Times 4th edition, and we are reading Peter St. Ange's piece. Peter St. Ange, PhD, actually. He's an economist. He's got a bunch of different great things, actually. I'll see if I can find maybe my favorite interview of his or whatever. I think he posts on like Mises Institute and stuff a lot. Definitely somebody to follow. Definitely somebody to check out. I'll have a link to explore a little bit his stuff in the show notes. But he has a great piece here in the Bitcoin Times called Bitcoin's Peaceful Revolution, A New Hope for Humanity. And it's a really, really good piece, and I think it does such a good job of summing up kind of the foundations of how it is the money printer truly creates this ever-increasing trend and feedback loop toward greater totalitarianism, toward greater government control, toward greater arbitrary government manipulation of the economy, and on and on. You know, when you have the fundamental power to edit the entire record of economic history, that is what the power to print money is. It is to essentially delete economic history and the distribution of resources that happen in the free market and turn it into distribution of the printing press. And also he even brings up the printing press in this, which is a really fun analogy that I know you've heard me go into many times on this show. But with that, let's go ahead and get into this piece. I want to thank our sponsors really quick. We've got the Fold Card, we've got Swan Bitcoin, we have the Bitbox O2 Hardware Wallet, and the Bitcoin 2022 Conference. These are all amazing services and companies in this space that do so much for it, so much for me. Like I say, you know, I pick my sponsors as the companies and the products that I use rather than the other way around. And they all provide links for you guys with discounts and special goodies and everything, which you can all check out in the show notes. But with that, let's get into today's read, and it is titled Bitcoin's Peaceful Revolution, A New Hope for Humanity, by Peter St. Ange, PhD. Human history is a long battle of centralization versus decentralization, of power versus people. Our current 400-year golden age began with the decentralization of the printing press, which allowed the people to organize, to battle, then to win fundamental rights. This victory ushered in the greatest human flourishing since agriculture, perhaps since fire, the liberal revolution, and the industrial revolution that it enabled. But that same printing press was misused by governments to seize the upper hand once more by seizing money. That power now threatens to plunge humanity back to the Dark Ages. Governments have used fiat money to step by step seize our fundamental liberties, then our prosperity, in a process that is now accelerating alarmingly. The empire struck back most dramatically with government money's first modern war, World War I, which inflicted a, quote, wartime socialism that was never dislodged, rather metastasized to the point it now threatens to return us to the brutal poverty that has characterized the vast majority of human history. Most assume our only hope is a political backlash that historically has not been peaceful. But there is another peaceful way that strikes at the heart of what drives this creeping totalitarianism: fiat money. Bitcoin's decentralization of money, its decentralization of the human interactions and organization that money enables, is our best hope to win the war for liberty without ever firing a shot. A new hope. The year is 2038. Little Satoshi runs home to give his dad his birthday present, a vintage block clock. Satoshi got it as a gag gift since dad keeps going on about his memes winning the money wars back in the 20s. Block clocks are going for 99 sats on eBay, cheaper since the dollar died, but a little pricey this year for the white paper's 30th anniversary. What does life look like for Satoshi and his battle-hardened meme-smith dad? You buy what you like with Bitcoin, instantly, without governments having a say. Unfashionable industries like ammunition, porn, coal, raw milk, or unapproved medicines are all at your fingertips. You pay near nothing in fees. You don't wait days for your money. You keep your savings on your own wallet. They grow year to year. You don't ask, you don't tell. There are no more business cycles because governments are out of the money business. This means an end to the decadal crises that ratchet up the state, from the dot-com crash in 2001 to the financial crisis in 2008 to the catastrophe in 2020. Without that permanent threat of worldwide crash, the financial pages aren't what they used to be. No more Jim Cramers hyperventilating about growth versus value or hedging the next disaster that everybody knows is coming. Instead, financial news is focused on what products are selling and what new inventions come along. In fact, Wall Street isn't what it used to be. Without subsidized debt and permanent bailouts from central banks, it returns to the boring, traditional role of banking. Low-risk loans to households or small businesses. Rather than leveraging 0% money to sling trillions at an endless parade of government-fueled bubbles. Nobody obsesses about banks' health or solvency. No stress tests in the headlines. Because banks are no longer systemically important. They're the same as any other group of investors. If they go under, it's their own problem. The biggest difference in financial news is the Fed. In 2035, nobody cares what Jerome Powell had for breakfast, because Powell's kind have useful jobs doing bookkeeping at machine tool workshops in Tulsa. The Federal Reserve Building, recall, was auctioned off as a burlesque venue. Their fortnightly open market shows with a donkey are particularly popular. Beyond the recycled Fed, our government is smaller across the board, tightened to doing more of what's actually useful. Going by history, it contracted by 80% or more, 5 times smaller when it lost the dollar. This is why our troops are home working real jobs, rather than shooting foreigners or standing guard for the empire. Governments still run deficits in 2038, as they did under gold. Politicians are irresponsible by nature, but much smaller now that they have to sell Bitcoin bonds to willing buyers rather than printing monopoly money. In daily life, perhaps the biggest change is the end of inflation. Stuff gets slightly cheaper every year, while Bitcoin gets slightly more valuable every year. Perhaps 5% or so annual, reflecting economic growth and a still growing population. Things cost less tomorrow than they did today, unlike the dollar days. The evening business news no longer obsesses about inflation rates or worries about the stagflation it can bring. Senior citizens are no longer forced to gamble in stock markets because their bank accounts actually pay a living interest rate. Businesses have an easier time making plans and getting their company off the ground. Finally, the culture. without permanent crisis, without permanently subsidized debt, without a permanently growing government, worldwide cultures shift toward more freedom and prudence rather than the hyperactive short-term obsession of the fiat era. The arts, music, architecture, and lifestyle choices settle towards a more traditional, more solid, more respectable ethos, rather than the witless chaos, destruction, and action for action's sake of the fiat era. From here to there. Returning to 2021. Today, a historical concept that has suddenly become relevant is the four-stage cycle of civilizational rise and fall. An iconic version runs, "Good times create weak men. Weak men create bad times. Bad times create strong men. Strong men create good times." The formula actually dates to at least Polybius's Histories, written in the 2nd century BC, where he calls it anacyclosis, or repeating cycle. The process itself is intuitive. Creation creates complacency. Complacency destroys. But the key unknown is the timing. We don't know how long each stage lasts. After all, there have been many eras of second winds that stopped or reversed decline. From Caesar Augustus's restoration, to Andrew Jackson killing central banks, to Warren G. Harding's half-won return to normalcy after the totalitarian World War I. On the other hand, potential reversals often never happen. President Eisenhower lacked the understanding to reverse FDR's socialist revolution, instead baking it in as party control solidified the new normal. So even if we know we're in the decline stage of Kyklos, we don't know how fast or how slow it will be, and we don't know whether we can stretch it out or reverse it. These past 2 years since COVID certainly seem to have rapidly accelerated the decline, as even supposedly liberal governments now lurch to a totalitarianism not seen in the West since the 1930s, and our economy, currently floating on money-printing life support, increasingly looks like it may have been mortally wounded during the epically misguided lockdowns over these past 2 years. While the Trump saga has led many to conclude that stopping, never mind reversing, the decline is hopeless. Indeed, there is a theory called accelerationism that maintains we actually want decline to go faster, because speed engages the immune system of the people to fight back. Like Aesop's frog in the boiling pot, rapid decline, quote, wakes enough people to the bullshit that they mentally cross the Rubicon. The individual tipping point could be any small thing, what their kids are being taught in school, empty grocery shelves, not being able to visit a dying relative, losing one's job over a mandate. Once these events click, like pulling a loose thread on a sweater, people go on to question the entire narrative. They quote, red pill. They follow the rabbit. Unfortunately, waking up is only the beginning to stopping the decline, because the next question is how precisely people fight back. If elections are unreliable, either for censorship or ballot stuffing, then there is only one avenue left: violence. Historically, indeed, many Kyklos do reach that stage of widespread violence, the French Revolution being one of the most iconic and most bloody examples. Of course, that's not yet guaranteed today. Elections are still contested, even if one side has an advantage, and if things get bad enough, if the boil gets loud enough that red pills cascade, even ballot stuffers abandon ship as surely as King Louis XVI's elite soldiers in revolutionary Paris. Still, there is potentially a lot of blood between here and there, and a lot of innocent victims caught in between. Moreover, we certainly can't be assured that the forces of light and liberty will prevail. Dark times. But now let's talk solutions. And this feels like a good time to pause and, you know, talk about actually something that is the most potent aspect of Bitcoin, in my opinion. Is the fact that it can be truly independently verified and independently owned. The first is done by running a full node, and the latter is done by holding your keys. Now, there's a lot of different ways to do this, and you should do it in any way that you can, but the best way to do it, in my opinion, is a simple, secure hardware wallet. And lucky for you, our sponsor has one of those, and it's one of the best, in my opinion, the Bitbox O2. So what a hardware wallet does for the new people is simply separates your keys, the keys to your Bitcoin, your very ownership of Bitcoin, from the internet-connected device that you are using to hold your wallet. By having the keys stay locked down on your Bitbox, the computer or the mobile phone, whatever it is, simply doesn't have access. It is literally a vault for your digital keys. And going ahead and getting one and learning how to secure your own Bitcoin, which the Bitbox actually makes as intuitive as it gets, literally, is one of the best things that you can do to prepare for our Bitcoin future. And plus, you get a 5% discount with code GUY at checkout. Snag yourself a Bitbox, secure your Bitcoin, and you got links and all that good stuff in the show notes, because I know you're going to forget this in like 6 seconds. But just remember, guyswan.com/bitbox, and it is all right there. With that, let's jump back into this piece. But now let's talk solutions. What would be super is if we had some peaceful mechanism that reduces the threat at the source, something that cuts off government's ability to seize resources arbitrarily, to launch permanent crises, and to drain our wealth to weaponize against us, and that something is Bitcoin. By cutting off the totalitarian threat at the source, rather than trying to stomp out its tentacles one by one, Bitcoin is an end run around politics, an end run around the bloodshed that Polybius' anachiclosis has historically entailed. It precisely cures the disease without amputating. Bitcoin as a technology can give us that return to normalcy. Indeed, it can rewind us to an earlier gold standard age before the socialist decline set in, before FDR and Nixon seized the money, before central banks cartelized the global economy, before socialism plunged the West from classical liberalism to government control. By taking away their printing presses, Bitcoin stops the creeping totalitarianism that weaponizes our own blood, sweat, and tears against us. It stops government's escalating ability to control all person-to-person exchange, their efforts to build a financial panopticon of Big Brother control, and finally, by getting governments out of the business of manipulating money, Bitcoin brings us a world without permanent crisis, without the boom-bust business cycles, without the inflation that ravages the people who those governments pretend to serve and love. Bitcoin is the one tool that liberates us from government without firing a shot. Indeed, they should be welcoming Bitcoin, because they certainly won't like the alternative. Bitcoin as Gutenberg 2.0. This is not the first time a technology changed the kyklos. In fact, liberalism itself, the most fundamental political fact of our age and the most significant political change since agriculture, came from a very mundane technology, the printing press. Imported from China in the 1400s, the printing press made it cheap to communicate and disseminate knowledge. Previously, monks would hand-copy documents in beautiful, ornate script that took a lot of resources that were unavailable to commoners. Movable type reduced these costs thousands-fold. The very first application of the new press was printing Bibles, which was ironically deeply revolutionary in an era when government-allied churches claimed a monopoly on information. If you like big tech censors today, you'd love the Catholic Church of the early 1400s. Almost immediately, and related, the new printing press was applied to explicitly political content, printing the pamphlets that launched peasant revolts across Europe. Revolts that didn't end until negotiated settlements guaranteed limited governments forced to protect property rights, from which flow all fundamental human rights. Those rights and limited governments, in turn, enabled the classical liberal revolution in science, then in industry and commerce, that gave us the modern world. The key in Gutenberg's press, as in Bitcoin, was decentralization. The printing press allowed cheap dissemination of information. That information allowed cheap coordination without the need for a central authority. This allowed commoners to organize in large enough numbers that they could overwhelm the centralized militaries that governments then, as today, needed. Before movable type, those centralized militaries could outfight a much larger population that lacked the ability to organize, but they could not stand up to a people armed with decentralized technology. Backroom presses could be set up in an afternoon to spread the revolution in the shadows. Indeed, they could be set up faster than governments could stamp them out. With movable type, you could announce a rally this Sunday, spread the word, and get 10,000 armed peasants faster than armies could even pack their wagons. As government's world spun out of their control, they did desperately fight back, ushering in over a century of bloodshed across Europe. But they finally capitulated, making peace with a liberal consensus that property rights and associated fundamental human rights like speech and religion would be respected. This consensus ushered in humanity's greatest flourishing, one that has now spread to most of the world from Japan to Botswana. The 1800s were the crowning achievement of this decentralized revolution. Indeed, the trajectory in the late 1800s was such that, had the socialists not seized the money to enable their counter-revolution, we would today have the science fiction world that utopians dream of. Alas, the 19th century liberal utopia crashed into flames as governments progressively seized money, enabling the cataclysm of the world wars. By 1914, every major power was aching for a fight, knowing they could fund it all by printing money, licensed counterfeiting. In the U.S., progressives machinated for, quote, war socialism, finally achieving their dreams of state control. They carried this dream into the essentially communist administration of FDR 15 years later. FDR's regime brought state control of all production and employment, even censorship enforced by jail time for political dissent. It was the collapse of classical liberalism, funded and brought to you by government seizure of money printing. Even after the war ended, fiat-fueled totalitarianism continued, quote, baked in by Eisenhower. As of 2021, two reformist presidents, Reagan and Trump, had now failed to dislodge it. And now, since COVID, that quasi-permanence has progressed to uncontrolled metastasization, with new restrictions on the economy, private life, indeed on fundamental human rights that were unthinkable just 2 years ago, never mind 200 years ago. What has sustained this socialist revolution from the start as it fuels today is government control of the money. It enabled the world wars. It enabled the welfare and regulatory state that half-killed the economic golden goose which classical liberalism won. It enabled permanent wars for 100 years, and now it enables trillions in tranquilizing lockdown payments so governments can fully seize not just the economy, but the entire society. Indeed, governments are now accelerating even their control of the money, seeking a totalitarian panopticon to monitor and control every human interaction. Whether via government, quote, crypto CBDCs or cynical tax and terrorism surveillance, the goal is to control and direct the masses' raw materials, molded clay, for whatever revolution governments and their ruling activists and media dream up next. This fiat-enabled trinity crush anything they disapprove of as hate speech or carbon sin, aiming for a totalitarianism where anything the state does not like cannot exist. It is in this darkest stage of the novel where Bitcoin enters. Almost miraculously invented on the very eve that totalitarianism took its 2008 lurch, at the very moment we need it most. What Bitcoin changes next? What would a Bitcoin world change right now? In the short run, governments would have a strong incentive to end lockdowns and terminate voluntary wars. After all, if taxes fell 50% from a lockdown, or if wars are eating up 25% of the budget, a government shorn of fiat cannot afford either. Once governments are forced to choose between wiping out commerce or invading another Afghanistan versus paying their own bureaucrats, the bureaucrats will get paid every time. Shorn of their money printers, governments would be forced, kicking and screaming, to do things that actually benefit the people. Not because politicians or bureaucrats are decent people, they are not, but because they need an economy to get taxes, and they need taxes to pay themselves and their armies. Fewer lockdowns means fewer restrictions, while fewer wars means fewer Patriot Acts. The trend moves back in our favor. Beyond reining in government, on a personal level, a Bitcoin world would end inflation and the business cycle almost immediately. Perhaps one last crash for the road to clear out the easy money detritus central banks are busily spreading today. There will have been a tremendous transfer of resources in the rise of Bitcoin, of course, from late-buying skeptics to early Bitcoiners. This means a lot of 20-something anarchist millionaires. Still, we have seen trillion-dollar transfers many times in the past, including fiat's real estate bubbles or dot-com manias, and society goes on. In fact, the trillion-dollar transfers that get riots aren't the ones that come from smart investing. They're the ones that come from crony government handouts, like in the 2008 financial crisis. And so, as in previous monetary replacements, as Bitcoin proceeds to displace fiat, the holdouts will join, one by one, cheering on the new money that is now protecting them as well. Finally, Bitcoin gives us the precise gift that Gutenberg's press gave us 500 years ago: the ability to coordinate, communicate, and organize. This is likely why the elite is so hostile to Bitcoin, and it fundamentally fulfills the original cypherpunk promise of the internet itself: a re-deification of we the plebs. As Bitcoin is used to run non-money applications on Bitcoin, quote, rails, from speech to information to permissionless commerce, humanity rests free of totalitarian command and control. Unlike today's centralized internet at the mercy of, and therefore enslaved by, totalitarian governments, Bitcoin is the technology that can finish the revolution the internet started. Finally, what happens if we walk away? If we Bitcoiners leave the miracle to die on the vine? Perma-crisis, with each episode ratcheting up totalitarianism. We careen towards stagnation, hyperinflation, and utter collapse. For the first time in history, potentially worldwide, as fiat cancer has spread unlike any threat in history. Without Bitcoin, surveillance, control, and censorship gallop, each escalation reducing our ability to escape. Dissent becomes criminal disinformation, even terrorism, as the system plunges to unsustainable debt and cronyism. As Herbert Stein put it, if something cannot go on forever, it will stop. Far better to stop fiat before fiat stops humanity. Conclusion. In conclusion, history says blood may be coming, but we have the savior we need, Bitcoin. It is now in our control to head off Ragnarok, to stop and reverse the collapse before it's too late. Centralization fueled by fiat money is crashing our world, armed with a level of control never before seen. And Satoshi gave us just in time the decentralized technology we need to fight that control peacefully, to disarm our oppressors, to end their crises, to protect and sustain the human rights and free markets that guarantee our liberty, indeed our survival. We need to move fast. They are using money printers and centralized finance to consolidate their control. Our window is narrowing. While their litany of victims is growing by the day, only with Bitcoin can we stop it. All right, and that wraps up Bitcoin's Peaceful Revolution, A New Hope for Humanity by Peter St. Ange. Like I said, I will have lots of show notes. Oh, actually, before, lots of stuff in the show notes, but before actually we get into that, I just want to say something. So there is a line in there that I know a lot of you are probably, I highly suspect some of you screamed into your phones or your earbuds, whatever. Bitcoin and it fundamentally fulfills why the state is so hostile to Bitcoin and it fundamentally fulfills the original cyberpunk. Oh, actually, that was written as cyberpunk. My bad. Cyberpunk promise of the internet itself. A re-deification of we the plebs. I said plebs because it is specifically spelled that way. P-L-E-B-E-S. And no, it was not spelled as plebs. And yes, I would have said it as plebs. I read through that part and I was like, oh man, I'm going to get, the tweets are going to come in on this one. And you know, to be completely fair, the word is plebeian. It is pronounced that way. So pleb doesn't really make sense, but you should say pleb because that's how you say it. But this was a this was a really great piece. Peter killed it with this one. And, you know, one of the things, like, so one of the main thesis that he kind of hinges this on is the, is that very intuitive, and I love also that, like, the idea of this being an intuitive cycle is, it is true. Like, I mean, it really is that creation or the growth of prosperity creates complacency, and complacency creates, complacency destroys, creates destruction. But it leads to this cycle of society, and it is one of those ideas that I probably, I mean, maybe I would have stumbled upon it, but Bitcoin just enlightens so many of these large civilizational trends because it forces you to step back. It forces you to have a long time preference about society in order to have any grasp of its understanding. If you're looking on a 5-year timescale as to what's important or what is directing society or what political system makes a difference here or there, you're going to see such a shallow, inconsequential view of reality that is truly so irrelevant to the actual functionings of the world that, you know, it's like missing the forest for staring at the tree that is right in front of you for so long and meticulously breaking it apart. So much of society is noise. And that's equally true, more true probably, of our political systems. If you aren't seeing the broad feedback loops, the fundamental incentives that cause it to direct a certain way, and you're just worried about each individual little piece and exactly why this foot was set in this direction as opposed to this, you're going to completely miss the picture. And Bitcoin is just such a fast, to make any decent understanding of Bitcoin, you have to pull back. You have to put on the glasses and look at, you have to look into the distance both ahead of you and behind you. And you have to see the world in a different way. It truly does. You will never understand Bitcoin without fundamentally changing something about your worldview. I believe, at least for the average person. Yeah, I'm sure there are people who, you know, kind of already were leading towards that foundation, or maybe there's the one-off chance of somebody who was born into the Austrian theory of economics and somebody who studies all of this stuff. But the culmination of all of the ideas and disciplines that make Bitcoin understandable is so often not only like just most of it is new to people, almost all of it is generally new to people. It's just a different way of looking at the world. But this was just a really good piece, very much in line with, what was it, Nick Carter's? Or Turtemist? No, it was Nick Carter's. Nick Carter's A Peaceful, Bitcoin, A Peaceful Revolution, that we read, God, I don't know how long ago, 2 years now? Man, time flies. Lot of great, a handful of great articles in this vein. And this one I felt like really kind of broke down the fundamentals in a really good way. Because when you can attack the state apparatus, the totalitarian apparatus at its fuel, at the very, you know, the blood of the system, which is the ability to manipulate the money, the ability to pay for things without contest. They do not actually need the resources because we store our past, the resources we already created, in these tokens. These tokens that they can just print out of thin air, that they don't have to work for. And the section that I did at the beginning of this, I read at the beginning of the show, that I just really, really loved, because I think this is, in fact, I tweeted it out also, because it's just so powerful, and I feel like it's lost. It's lost on all of society that we are the ones funding this totalitarianism. Like, I know, yes, okay, we're funding it through taxation, but that is not it, because that is what's visible. And the very apparatus that allows them to easily tax us more, the very mercenaries that they hire in order to enforce their taxation, is supported by the money printer, by the fact that they have control over the money. They wouldn't even be able to have the apparatus to enforce the taxation in the same way without the ability to print the money in order to get the power to steal the taxes. It would so fundamentally change our relationship to the way that government gets their funds. It's a, what was the piece? I think it was in this, in Bitcoin Times edition 4 here. Maybe it was the next one. Was it Changing the Course of History? Yeah, The Separation of Money and State. So it was Alan Farrington's piece where he talks about how power and money, like money always begets power. Like, you always achieve some degree of control. It is literal command over resources. That is what money is. So if you have an ungodly amount of money, you have power in some way, shape, or form. That is what it is. But the problem is the feedback loop. The problem is the incentives of the government structure when government takes over the creation of the money. Because then power also begets money. It means that the more power you have, the more money you have. Not because you produce more value, not because you're better at economic output, not because you have traded with more people, but because you can counterfeit the token that everyone else is producing for. So you are just stealing everyone's resources without their awareness of it. It is licensed counterfeiting. That is all it is. And that's why I opened with the quote of, by taking away their money presses, their printing presses, Bitcoin stops the creeping totalitarianism that weaponizes our own blood, sweat, and tears against us. That is what it does. It means that every time that you are working to fix somebody else's internet or make a sandwich or build a house, fix a car, repair, whatever it is, whatever you're producing or doing in society, what you are actually doing is fueling that state apparatus, because you accept their money, their counterfeit tokens, in exchange for it. They are making you work to create your own cage, to create your own system of control over top of you. and they just siphon it through, like, out of society slowly over extended periods, and it just grows and it grows, and the more it grows, the faster and the more efficiently it can continue to siphon money away from you, because the more power it has, the more money it has. Because money is explicitly a creation of political power, of fiat. When you remove that, when you make money an independent, market-driven tool again, something that people select voluntarily, that is not forced on anyone, and that is not a product of state declaration, you have changed everything that has occurred in the last 100, 120 years in this country. In all of Western society, actually. You move us back, and that's what's so crazy that I think Peter, like, really kind of hits well in this piece, is that this isn't a return to, like, 1995. This is literally a return to pre-World War I. This is a return to sensible fiscal policy. This is a return to actually understanding that there is a cost to everything we do. And the culture that has spun up, that has grown around the rot, around the poison of that government parasite, will die with it, because it's a completely unsustainable culture. It worships something that literally causes the death and collapse of society, and that it will actually correct business cycles, because business cycles are specifically because prices are not able to tell us the truth of what's going on in the economy. So we continue to go into debt, even though the normal prices, the actual price of interest rates on an open market where you can't print money and you can't issue debt out of thin air, the price of the interest rate would tell us to stop borrowing, like, immediately. It wouldn't prolong for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years until we go through this massive, absurd crisis where millions of people are out of a job and 20% of the freaking economy just shuts its doors. That doesn't happen naturally. That is because prices are not able to communicate. It doesn't happen in Bitcoin. People talk about, like, oh, Bitcoin crashed by 30% in, like, 2 months. This is proof that Bitcoin is real prices. The imbalances last weeks at best. That is the boom and bust cycle. It ended last month. And we're back to an intelligent, sustainable price level. We have real feedback from the economy, and we know the reality of the production, the savings, and the consumption and the leverage in our economy. Right now, that leads to insane volatility because it is a monetizing good, because the network is growing rapidly, because the use cases and the number of people buying it is growing rapidly, and there are tons of speculators because of that rapid growth. There's tons of profit to be made from buying it while it's low and selling it while it's high for all the people who don't have a clue what this thing is and are idiots who are just trying to pick up peanuts in front of a freight train. But it is proof that we do not have systemic risk. That is how we can know the business cycle won't exist. Or that at best, it will just be a seasonal thing, that as soon as leverage starts to get too great and we can't support any more debt, then it corrects. It corrects. And so does the behavior of the people within that economy. It is able to adjust to the reality of the situation. And thus, we do not have giant obnoxious booms that are unsustainable and crazy psychotic crashes where millions of people lose their jobs and entire swaths of the country, the entire population are totally devastated and it takes years and years to recover. We have little weekly swings, and anybody who isn't completely stupid just saves when the price is low or when the purchasing power is low and uses it when the purchasing power is high. And the overall trend and feedback loop of that is more and more stability, sustainable markets, and less volatility as time goes on. It is all about the trend. And there's another part in this, actually, that I really like. You know, I talking about the bigger cycle, the civilizational cycle, and the good men create good times, or strong men create good times, blah, blah, blah. When he talks about the theory of accelerationism, I have always been like, I don't like accelerationism. You know, like the pain of these sorts of transitions is so ridiculous. Like, I have my moments where I'm like, screw it, let's just pull the plug on this thing. Jesus Christ, let it die. This is insane. But really, like, I'm in such a comfortable position in the U.S. so far. Like, we really have not struggled yet. And the inevitable pain of this crisis, you know, the debt bubble is so huge. It is so unbelievably huge. And every time I really think about it, I fall back into that scene from The Big Short, when those guys are just laughing and having fun, and Brad Pitt, oh God, what's his character? Pickard. He basically tells him to shut up, says, stop it. This is not good. People are losing their lives, their jobs, their families. Like, this is devastation that is going on while we are profiting from this. And that guy's like, you know, shit, I just got really scared. I feel like that constantly happens to me when I try to readjust and find my center and think about really what the outcome of all of this is going to be. It scares me. But the crazy thing is we're better positioned than we ever have been. We have a better tool to sort out our problems than we ever have. So I don't know to what degree, to how great of a degree and how quickly that will alter the course of history. How long does it take to unravel that? And how much damage is done in order to get resources back to their proper place, to reallocate in the way the market is actually screaming at us to reallocate? But there's a really great quote that I hadn't quite heard it. Like, I always knew the argument for accelerationism, and I talked about it before. You know, it's like, it's not a new idea, you know? Like, obviously there is an intuitive argument to accelerationism. I hadn't quite heard it this way. And so I'm just going to read the quote real quick before we close this out. So it says, indeed, there is a theory called accelerationism that maintains we actually want decline to go faster, because speed engages the immune system of the people to fight back. Like Aesop's frog in the boiling pot, rapid decline wakes enough people to the bullshit that they mentally cross the Rubicon. Now, this is a way to illustrate that I don't know I had... Somehow it's like a little bit clearer after he said that. And what's funny is that the pot won't get as hot if we let it, if it actually does move faster, move rapidly for a short period of time. It is explicitly because of the slow boiling that the frog does not notice it. So if it gets, even if we're at low temperatures, if it gets hot very quickly, the frog realizes what is up. And I feel like that's what's happened in 2020 and 2021, is that we're reaching the end game of the debt collapse, of the financial system that is absolutely doomed. Like, the whole thing is going to literally implode. And because of that, they have had to accelerate to an incredible degree their actions of control, lockdown, enforcing their panopticon, because I think they are preparing for it. I don't think anybody high up in the financial system is so stupid they do not see that a societal collapse is on the, that they are on the verge of societal collapse, that the debt, the structure, the very foundation of the monetary system of the globe is a shit show. It is, the whole thing is going to go up in flames, and they are preparing for controlling populations and controlling governments and political institutions around the world so that they are still in charge when the smoke clears. But because of that, they have had to boil the pot rapidly, and all the frogs are waking up, and there just so happens to be a little Bitcoin life raft or a Bitcoin ladder to get the hell out of the pot. And damn it, are we lucky to have that solution, to have. And I love to, you know, it's like, it is kind of miraculous. It seems insane that this happened on the eve of all of this, of really the unfolding of all of this in 2008 and 2009, when this endless bailout, debt printing, central bank, buying bonds, buying equities, this total government control of the economy really just turned on. It's like Bitcoin popped into existence at the exact same time. And it's really crazy. It's just a little serendipitous there. Okay. I told myself, I was starting this like, there's no way I have time for a guy's take. So we're just going to go ahead and close it out. A thank you to Fold. A thank you to the Audionauts. A thank you to Bitbox. A thank you to Swan Bitcoin and the Bitcoin 2022 conference for making this show possible. This is Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan. And until next time, everybody, have a wonderful Valentine's Day, and I'll see you on the next one. Take it easy. You have been listening to Bitcoin Audible, a 111 production.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.